You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to the 6th episode of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton,
and I am Tristan Caracino.
And big news, we have a logo.
We have a logo. I really like it. This is an idea I conceived not too long ago, and I assigned you to make.
And then we had a dramatic fight on Saturday about which was more important, and I threatened that we would no longer be able to use it, but I've relented on that.
Wait, about what was more important, between the logo and what?
Oh, the idea and the execution.
I still stand by the idea. So speaking of the idea and the execution, we have a little bit of breaking news here on the Fabulous Pelton Cast. Just recently, you did a projection for the New York Knicks, correct?
I actually did it a long time ago, but it came out yesterday.
The projection for the New York Knicks came out yesterday. I'm looking at a delightful photo of Carmelo Anthony here.
He's actually scoffing at the projection in the photo, is the weird thing.
The title of the article is Knicks Scoff at Computer's 37 Win Projection. And so here's the quote. It is, Anthony reacted with surprise Wednesday when informed of a projection for the Knicks to go 37-45 this season based on an ESPN system called Shaney. That would be a steep drop-off from last season's 54-28 record, which was good enough for the second seed in the Eastern Conference. Carmelo replied, sometimes there's glitches in the computer, Anthony said. That's all I can say.
Well, the interesting thing is that we're looking right now, we're reading this on the computer.
I'm staring at the computer that projected this.
It's a pretty famous computer at this point. It's very few computers have been referenced by Carmelo Anthony and also Mike Woodson.
Think about this ironic situation here going on. We're looking at on the computer that projected the Knicks to go 37-45. Add a picture of Carmelo Anthony scoffing at this.
It's very meta.
But I really like the idea of that the computer itself is making the projections.
Well, you gotta understand that probably the way this question is being asked by whoever is asking the question is there's a computer projection that says the Knicks are going 37-45. They're probably not explaining the whole Shaney process to Carmelo Anthony.
And yeah, he's like, let me tell you about Shaney. But really,
they should stop for like a 15-minute breakdown. They read the FAQ.
So can we go through your process here really quick? What you do, as I understand it, is you go, computer, tell me Nick's projection. And then it goes, beep, 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 beep. Hello, Kevin. The Knicks record will be 37-45.
Well, the computer is actually a lot like How. It's a punch sheet that it gets printed out where it just
it comes out really slowly somewhere out of the computer here. It goes,
and imagine my surprise when it came out this year. It said Knicks 37 wins. I was pretty stunned.
Carmelo Anthony scoffed at that.
I mean, yeah, you know, I can't blame him. The thing is, if I were them, I would kind of embrace it. To me, the whole thing is, you should try to have low expectations. We're actually going to talk about this later in the episode.
Try to have low expectations. This 37-win projection that you have for the Knicks has really caused a big stir right now nationally.
It has. Stephen A. Smith is discussing it on the air. Jeff Van Gundy discussed it yesterday on ESPN New York. I mean, when I was like creating the Shaney projection system, like the first start of it was like 9 years ago, when I was still in college, I think, or maybe just out of college. I really did not anticipate that it would become national news.
And that Carmelo Anthony would be responding to it. I wish that he would have used the word Shaney, too.
I don't think that probably came up again during the interview. I mean, my favorite part is the people that think that this is like just an effort to troll Knicks fans or because ESPN hates the Knicks or something like that. Like, there's a variable in there where
the computer has personal feelings about the Knicks.
Yeah, that's my favorite part. I mean, look, if you think it's crazy, I don't blame you. I mean, when I look at it for the first time, I thought it was pretty crazy. It may well be horribly wrong, but you know, that's
you
the
have
way,
to do what the computer says.
That's the way projections work. I don't believe in putting your thumb on the scale because who's to say then I couldn't do that and then it would be a bias.
Absolutely. And so you said that Tom Haberstroh was on with Stephen A. Smith.
Yeah.
Screaming A. Smith.
The tough thing is that Tom wrote about this, so he's the one that gets all the blame for the projection, even though he had nothing to do with it.
Even though this computer here is not in his abode. I would have loved to have heard you on Stephen A. Smith and him just tearing you apart. That would have been one of my favorite things to hear in the entire world. It would have been a lot different than doing this podcast or doing a podcast with one of your other friends about your whole life and how you've gotten to the point that you're at.
Which was, I cheated on this podcast last week. I went on a different podcast. I hope you're not okay. I hope you're not upset, phone that we're using to record this.
Computer, are you angry? Please don't destroy us. You're doing a lot of cheating on me lately. That sounds weird.
Is this about trivia?
Yes, it is. But you also went to a trivia night with one of my friends, David Sykes, without inviting me. And then you won at that trivia. Thank God you didn't win anything good.
Well, I mean, it was kind of inevitable. I mean, we had me.
You had you. I understand why he would want you there. But part of the issue is, when you get you, I have to go along also.
This is very much like the little brother wants to tag along.
David was describing it as, God, I like to hang out with Kevin, but his dorky little brother has to go everywhere.
Well, I think that there could be an olive branch that we could definitely... I would love to have you on our team. I think you would strengthen us immeasurably with your knowledge of pop culture and music in particular.
Pass.
Wow.
No thanks.
I guess we burned that bridge.
I'm pretty busy having fancy parties at the Columbia Tower Club. I don't think that going to Jabu's Pub is going to fit into my life.
See, that's where I think, you know... I don't want to invite someone who's just going to turn us down. I think that's probably where it started in the first place.
Oh, do you? I think you're scared.
What would I be scared of?
I have no idea. But now you're scared. I don't think you were scared before, but now you're scared of me starting a rival team, getting together a whole host of characters, starting a rival team, sitting on the other side of Jabu's Pub, and beating your team at trivia.
I would welcome that, and you could enjoy some Big Al Harvest beer, which was fine and delicious.
Well, that sounds like that's delicious.
Doesn't it?
But also, we talked about this. When the trivia transfer period opens, I think you're going to be up on the market and see which team you're going to go to.
I'm open for offers.
You're open for offers?
Yeah.
Right now, you're like Gareth Bale. You started out over there on this English team, but you're going to move up to the big boys at Real Madrid soon.
I mean, really, I started playing trivia like 45 years ago.
That was Youth Academy. David's team is Spurs. And you're going to go to Real Madrid.
This is a very involved analogy.
Of you as Gareth. You should be happy that you're
I'm not unhappy.
Being compared to Gareth Bale, really, that's a pretty good situation for you to be in. It's pretty high comparison.
It's the nicest thing anyone said to me all day between the Knicks projection and Kobe Bryant ranking 25th in NBA rank.
And, well, Kobe Bryant ranks 25th in NBA rank?
Yeah, read all about it in my column explaining why.
That is what's coming next.
That's up there already.
First, you told Carmelo Anthony that his team sucks. Now you're telling Kobe Bryant that he personally sucks?
Unfortunately, all the blame for that one has gotten directed to my colleague Amin El-Hassan. So
about Kobe Bryant?
He's just taking it on Twitter.
What you do is you just lob this stuff out there and then let other people get attacked for it.
I didn't make it. It's the whole panel. There's like
it's the computer who made it.
There's 130 voters. No one got upset about Kobe's warp.
Oh, you personally didn't?
No, I just wrote an explanation about it.
Okay, well, that's better.
Yeah.
I suppose.
I guess.
So anyway, obviously the NBA season is kicking off soon. We'll have tons of conversations about that. But this past weekend, it was a 500 weekend for both of us. The Huskies obviously lost to Oregon. Seahawks beat Tennessee. The Sounders lost to Portland, a rough loss. And we each won our fantasy matchups.
So it was a lot better than the weekend before, but still some severe ups and downs within the weekend. I mean, you know, the Seahawks were very much expected to win, and it was maybe more nerve-wracking than it could have been, but eventually they took care of business. And Huskies, we didn't necessarily expect them to win, but we hoped it would probably be better than it was.
So I wanted to talk about the Seahawks for a second. You said that they were expecting to win. Maybe they didn't win by as much as folks were expecting them to. But I've noticed in this last week, it was a 500 weekend, we should be feeling neutral, maybe semi-positive. But I've noticed there's a lot of unrest in Seattle, particularly among Seahawks fans. Have you noticed this also?
Yeah, I mean, you look at Jerry Brewer's column in the Seattle Times on Monday, which, you know, pointed to, what, questions abound about the Seahawks?
Yeah, questions abound. And I think that I've made the mistake of listening to sports talk radio a little bit in the last week for brief periods of time. And the general consensus seems to be that people are not happy with the Seahawks. So I want to take a moment here and address this issue.
You want to take all Seahawks fans?
No. I'm happy with Seahawks fans in general. It's just this idea that something is not happening that should be happening. So quickly, what are we expecting? Right now the Seahawks are 5-1. They're good by advanced metrics. From DVOA, they're second in the league, Football Outsiders. Their offense is 10th in the league. Defense is second in the league. Special teams are 6th in the league. All near the top of the league, in the top third. They're 5-1. They have the schedule throughout the year to gain the number one seed in the playoffs. There's really no reason to be disappointed whatsoever. We lost at Indianapolis in a game that they probably should have won. Every single game this season, there's only one, and that's probably Houston, where I would have said that the Seahawks should have lost that game. We're coming off a game against the Titans where the Seahawks significantly outplayed Tennessee. It just so happened to be that the scoreboard didn't bear that out till the very end. In consecutive weeks, they've had fluke plays, which were 10-point swings, where they're kicking a field goal and the other team scored a touchdown. I can't imagine that happening almost any time for the rest of the season. It would be some sort of extreme bad luck if that happens a third or even a fourth time. In those games, if they hit those things, the Seahawks probably beat the Colts, and they're going to beat the Titans in a much more sound fashion. Russell Wilson has been extremely consistent. He hasn't thrown a lot of touchdown passes, maybe less than he did last year, but he's run the ball really well. Our receivers are playing well. The defense is playing at probably a higher clip than we would have expected at this time. I don't really understand what the expectation was.
Well, I'm going to turn this around on you, because I like to do. Let's talk about your fantasy team, even though it's not the fantasy section. Your fantasy team is 4-2, has scored by far the most points in the league, wins all tiebreakers, and is in first place. And yet, you're still upset because you envisioned this is the perfect season.
Yeah, my perfect season is
so
two losses.
So your opinion about your fantasy team is very similar to me, to the way Seahawks fans have perceived this season. Like, it's close enough to being 6-0 that you focus on not being 6-0 as opposed to all the very good things that the Seahawks have done to get to 5-1.
I think that those are probably two pretty separate issues here. But it's true, and really the issue is this the idea of expectation. All we need the Seahawks to do, our number one goal with the Seahawks, is to get the first seed in the playoffs, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's that and stay healthy. That's all that matters during the regular season.
And they are set up perfectly right now to get that number one seed in the playoffs, especially with the Saints losing to the Patriots and playing the Saints at home. Right now, they're doing this all without many key parts who are injured. You've got Percy Harvin, obviously the star wide receiver, who's gone and could be back within the next 2 or 3 weeks. They played most of the season without key offensive linemen, without Russell Okung, one of the best offensive linemen in the league, without Breno Giacomini, without Max Unger for a game. They've done it defensively, still the second best defense in the league, after the Chiefs, who I'm going to compare to the 85 Bears later. They're number two after the Chiefs, without Chris Clemens for a period of time, without Bruce Irvin for 4 games, without Brandon Browner for a period of time. What are these expectations? We should be thanking the gods that we're 5-1 right now.
Thanking the gods. Well, I wanted to get back to what you were saying about schedule. Football Outsiders says that the Seahawks' future schedule is 31st in the league, that the only team with an easier slate of games remaining, Tennessee, oddly, having already gotten Seattle out of the way. But New Orleans, by contrast, has the fourth hardest schedule remaining.
And where's San Francisco on there also?
San Francisco is also very low. They're 29th.
I suppose the NFC West just plays easy teams.
Well, it just turned out that the AFC South is much softer than we expected, and the good team in there, Indianapolis, both of those teams have already played. So that schedule turned out not to be as difficult as we're looking at. But anyway, that's again, the big advantage why the Seahawks have the inside track on the number one seed, along with the fact that they're also just playing the best of those teams. So, you know, all of that is positives. I think if I'm looking at reasons for concern, I mean, I think the third down struggles the last few weeks are probably right up there.
And do you want to talk more about the third down struggles?
Yeah, you know, I broke it down using Pro Football Reference's play index tools and ran some numbers on it. So the first 3 weeks of the season, the Seahawks converted 41.5% of their first downs. The last three games, actually I'm including third and fourth downs because I think those should be put together. Last three games, they're only 29.5%. And one of the first things I thought was, well, the offensive line has been struggling, obviously, with the injuries. Are they in worse situations? And the answer is actually no. They were averaging 8.2 yards to go for the first down and for the first 3 weeks of the season. And since then, it's been 7.1 yards on third and fourth down, which is actually pretty much league average. The surprising thing is the first 3 weeks, the Seahawks were actually kind of getting kind of lucky. They picked up 3 third downs of 11 yards or longer, I think almost all on Doug Baldwin catches.
I was going to say, you have to give some credit to Doug Baldwin there.
Absolutely. And Doug Baldwin actually is... He's picked up 9 of the 21 first downs that the Seahawks have converted through the air this year. But the other interesting thing is, early in the season, it was all passing conversions. Of the 17 third or fourth downs the Seahawks picked up, 15 were by pass. One was a Russell Wilson scramble, and one was a rush by Spencer Ware, actually, at the end of the Jacksonville game. The last 3 weeks, they've picked up, again, 13. 6 of them have been by pass. 5 of them have been by Russell Wilson scramble and 2 by rush. So I think that, again, gets back to the offensive line. Wilson hasn't had that time to throw, and when he's picking up these third downs, it's been with his legs get scrambling out of pressure.
But you also agree that third downs tend to be generally fairly random.
They're definitely much more random than...
Than the other aspects of the game. I actually think that this third down conversion rate, instead of being a cause for concern, the fact that they're at the bottom of the league right now and 5-1 is a cause for excitement going forward.
Let me put it this way. The difference between the Seahawks being league average and being as poor as they've been over the last 3 weeks is 4 conversions. So, you know, you turn one of those Golden Tate plays where Alteron Verner was able to break up a slant, you know, early in the first quarter on Sunday, turn one of those or 2 of those into completions, and all of a sudden the numbers look much better. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think it's worth freaking out about.
The third down conversions?
No. And in general, you know, I think the Seahawks are doing what they should do. I think the other thing, you know, you're right, expectations is all of it, and expectations are so important in every aspect of life. But part of why these expectations are so out of whack is the end of last season when the Seahawks were just crushing opponents left and right. But as we've talked about before, that's not the NFL. The NFL is most of the time about grinding out close victories, and the Seahawks still have the third best point differential in the league right now.
Absolutely. So basically, we should feel good. Right now, we should be feeling very good. Our chances of getting that first seed are still very high. I think this cause for panic is just maybe a need to think something right now.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of it, is there has to be a storyline. Team playing as expected does not play well as a story. You know, you have to find, if it's a team playing well, you find where are the weak links. What is the team doing that's falling short of expectations? So should we look ahead to tomorrow's Thursday night game against Arizona, a short week?
Absolutely. So looking forward, to be honest, I'm scared of the Cardinals.
Yeah.
After saying all of this about how I feel like the Seahawks are playing to expectations, probably even better than some of my expectations, and playing like the second best team in the league, I'm scared of the Arizona Cardinals. Right now, the Cardinals rank 24th on offense. They're not a particularly great offensive team. 7th defensively, though, 21st on special teams. And we talked last week about how kind of the cream of the NFL is really good on special teams. And that's probably part of the reason why the Cardinals are a little bit lower. But they are .500 with a pretty poor offensive line. And that's how good that defense has been playing.
Yeah, I mean, that's historically been the strength of their team. And, you know, they've been just kind of decimated by their quarterback play in the past. So when they get even mildly competent quarterback play, which is about where I'd place Carson Palmer so far this season, then that makes them a dangerous team.
That's true. They're especially good against the run, so I would not expect the Seahawks to run the ball particularly well tomorrow. Russell Wilson scrambling is a bit of a wild card in there. They limited Colin Kaepernick pretty heavily. Last week against the 49ers, they held Frank Gore to 4 yards per carry, which is lower than he's averaging, but didn't exactly stop Frank Gore completely. And the 49ers won that game and scored 32 points. But they're especially good at running to the left side, at stopping runs to the left side, which is where you'd probably expect the Seahawks not to try to run with Paul McQuiston having struggles over there at left tackle and with Russell Okung out. Their secondary is a little bit weaker. Patrick Peterson is obviously one of the emerging cornerbacks in the NFL, but they haven't been as strong as the D-line.
One thing that stood out watching off and on Sunday's game against San Francisco, obviously 2 long touchdown passes to Vernon Davis. Has that been an issue for them all season?
I have no idea. I have no research on this, on whether the tight end has been an issue for them all season.
Well, that struck me as intriguing, especially with Zach Miller coming back into the lineup this week.
I thought about that also. I did no research on how they did against the tight end. It was something that I was considering, but I wanted to focus more on their strong run defense and looking at what they did at Doug Martin in week 4 from Tampa Bay. Doug Martin, obviously one of the best running backs in the NFL last season. They held him to 45 yards on 27 carries, good for 1.7 yards per carry.
That's a little disconcerting, but obviously they were able to load up against the run, against Tampa Bay, and Mike Glennon making his first start. Russell Wilson's going to present a little bit more of a threat than that. And I think what is interesting, you mentioned Patrick Peterson, and he's a shutdown guy. So if you're a team that has one primary wide receiver, I think that's a big issue. But someone like the Seahawks, where they spread the ball around as much as they do, and you know, probably their best receiver is Doug Baldwin, certainly statistically.
Absolutely.
I think that's, you know, an advantage for the Seahawks. If you take away Golden Tate or Sidney Rice, fine. There's plenty of other guys out there for Russell to find.
Looking on the other side of the ball, Carson Palmer has been kind of the weakest point for the Cardinals. You say that he's playing like a league average quarterback. Right now, he's not.
No, I said marginally competent.
A marginally competent quarterback.
Which is a major upgrade over John Skelton, and I can't even, Brian Hoyer was actually out there. Whoever else they were throwing at him.
Not sure that he's playing that much better than John Skelton and Brian Hoyer. Right now, he's playing.
They lost 58-0 to the Seahawks last year. Okay, let's. Do I have to drag up the box score from that game?
Right now, he's the 32nd ranked quarterback per Football Outsiders, which ranks him not dead last, but of 32 teams, there's more quarterbacks who play than that. He has 11 picks in 6 games. In this game coming up, I do believe that the Seahawks are going to have a hard time moving the ball. I think that the difference is going to be not if, but when Carson Palmer throws at least an interception, if they're able to turn it into points or a long return and get something there.
I agree with that. I think that, you know, I thought this about a few games where it hasn't necessarily come true, but I think this will definitely be a situation where it's a low-scoring game and a couple of big plays, a pick six, a thing like that, could really just change the entire tenor of the game and have an incredible impact on the outcome. The other thing, the thing that concerns me in that regard is Andre Ellington is a big play weapon for the Cardinals. If they finally turn him loose and stop plunging Rashard Mendenhall into the line for 2 yards in a cloud of dust.
Yeah, we'll see what they end up doing with Andre Ellington, their rookie running back. He's been especially good this season. He's, by Football Outsiders, one of the best running backs in the league. He's been the top runner who hasn't had enough carries to qualify as kind of their main running back category. He's been much significantly better than Rashard Mendenhall, but they do have a tendency to turn the ball over there too, and Bruce Arians has shown a willingness to continue with Rashard Mendenhall, basically.
You wanted to come up with a stronger word there. A blind spot for Rashard Mendenhall, maybe? I don't know.
He's had a strong urge to run Rashard Mendenhall.
You just got to resist that urge. But after Thursday. After Thursday.
So I would expect it to be a low-scoring game, and we'll see what the Seahawks can get going offensively. I would not expect the Cardinals to put together too many long-sustained drives. That said, what do you think the chances are of winning this game?
I would say somewhere around 70%. I mean, you're going on the road against a decent opponent. You certainly have a realistic chance of losing, but you know, I think the Seahawks are the solid favorite, if not heavy favorite.
I'm curious to hear you say that high, because I was thinking 60%, and most often I've been more confident than you've been. But the last few weeks, you've been more confident than me, which I suppose has been a good thing.
Well, if it plays out correctly, yes.
But I was thinking it was about a 60% chance of victory. I'm very scared of that Cardinals defense. And if the turnovers that Carson Palmer commits or Rashard Mendenhall fumbles and it doesn't necessarily lead to anything and the offense stalls, it might not take very many points for the Cardinals to win this game.
True. The upside is that the Seahawks, outside of last week's bizarre fumble-itis, I guess it was contagious a little bit last week, have taken very good care of the football. And, you know, you certainly don't worry about Russell Wilson in terms of protecting the football and winning the turnover battle.
So we turn our attention to the Washington Huskies. This last week, they lost to number 2 Oregon, facing who we've discussed if he's the best quarterback the Washington Huskies have ever faced. I don't know if you included your research in that.
I did not.
In here. So we had a brief conversation, and I think we both settled on yes.
Which sounds crazy to think about it, but you know, the Huskies have faced, it's partially got to be on an absolute scale as opposed to a relative scale, because passing in the NCAA has evolved so dramatically over the past even 5 years, maybe, that, you know, someone like Carson Palmer or Matt Leinart, is because they were at USC, do not dominate a game in quite the same way that Mariota does as a dual threat. So from that standpoint, I think the only comparison is RG3 in the Alamo Bowl a couple of years ago, after he had already won the Heisman, the Huskies faced him. And yet still, even though I think they scored, what, like 70 points and had about 9,000 yards of offense, those are approximate figures, still felt like the Huskies' defense was more hopeless in the second half trying to figure out a way to stop Mariota.
And they scored 67 points in that game.
A slight exaggeration with 70, but not
And gained more. 777 yards.
Well, if you like that sort of thing.
I don't think Baylor had the defense that Oregon has. The main players we were comparing Marcus Mariota to were Griffin, RG3, Andrew Luck, Drew Brees, and John Elway.
Yeah, I mean, and Leinart and Palmer also has to be in that discussion, probably from recent eras. I mean, Jim Plunkett, if you go back a ways.
The difference
Dan
from
Fouts, I guess.
The difference from Mariota really was his scrambling ability, though, and the yards he gains on the ground, where he's averaging almost 10 yards per carry on the ground. RG3 had a higher completion percentage, but is only averaging about 3 yards per carry on the ground that season.
And the other thing we looked at is this a product of the Oregon system? But Mariota's numbers so far this year are far above and beyond what any of his predecessors have done. I mean, you know, they've had a lot of guys who are competent passers and good runners, but he's elite in both categories. And that's what really sets them apart, and I think makes Oregon right now possibly the favorite to win the championship.
Absolutely. So you wanted to look at the Huskies and do kind of a mid-season review, see how they're looking after these first 6 games.
Yeah, we're midway through the season. It's also kind of a natural breaking point because we've had these 2 Stanford and Oregon games. The very most difficult of the schedule is behind us, although I think there are some very tricky games left ahead on the schedule. But, 4-2 so far, I think that probably is about as optimistic as you reasonably could have been going into the season. And I think there was a very real chance of 3-3 or even 2-4 with, you know, Boise State and at Illinois looking like tricky, even Arizona looking like tricky games. So the Huskies navigated all of those, nearly won at Stanford, exceeded expectations there. And I think, you know, last Saturday was probably the first time that they've fallen short of expectations. And even then, it was really more Oregon was that good than Washington was that bad.
And on an individual player level, has anybody stood out to you, not stood out, or do you want to talk about?
Well, Bishop Sankey has stood out. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's one of the country's leading rushers, and he's on pace to set the all-time Husky single-season rushing record, something I've looked at on the blog week by week starting last week. He's been terrific. I think that the only downside so far is that I think he's surely gone to the NFL after this season at this point. But he gets an A+ if we're grading guys at midseason.
Okay. How about if we start? So we've got Bishop Sankey, probably the star player on the team. What about Keith Price? Do you have a grade for him?
I think so far an A. He's taken good care of the football, which was the biggest issue last season. You know, most of the mistakes he's made have been the case of something not a route not being quite run right or that sort of thing, as opposed to him being inaccurate. And, you know, he's one of the leaders in the Pac-12 conference among quarterbacks in QBR, behind one of the guys chasing Mariota. I think he's been everything you could ask for in his senior season.
What do you think about the potential, Keith Price's potential in the NFL right now, as it stands right this second?
I think it's probably underrated by most people because they, you know, want to see that classic 6'3" quarterback with a strong arm. It's a really interesting contrast to Jake Locker, his predecessor, who was basically the platonic ideal of what the NFL looks for in the quarterback, but didn't, you know, until this season before he got injured, didn't have that one thing, accuracy, that really tends to be underrated and determining factor in how well guys do in the NFL, and Keith Price has that.
Yeah, the big difference between Locker and Price is definitely that completion percentage. It's pretty massive between those two.
So, I mean, I think you have some questions about his durability at his size. He's obviously been banged up throughout his UW career, but, you know, if you're looking at a guy in the 5th or 6th round as a project and someone who might be able to eventually become a starting quarterback for you, I think that could be a very good value.
And then what about the receiving options? Obviously, the Huskies last season basically had Kason Williams and Austin Safarian Jenkins. This year have kind of a myriad of options. Do you want to break them down individually or talk about a few individuals?
Well, I mean, I think let's start with the wide receivers, because I think that's where you've seen the most dramatic change. You know, last year, Kayson Williams was the only wide receiver that had more than 20 catches all season. Already this season, both Kevin Smith and Jadon Mickens, who actually leads the team in receptions so far, have cleared that bar. So you've got really three options out there, all of them performing very effectively. And that, to me, is a big difference. You know, last year, the other thing is the guys who were the number three and four options, DeAndre Campbell caught 52% of the passes thrown in his direction. Jadon Mickens is a freshman, caught 59%. This year, Mickens is catching 85% of the passes thrown to him. I mean, that's partially a factor of it's a lot of the short stuff at the line of scrimmage, the bubble screens, that type of thing. But he's just so much more sure-handed and reliable, and that's a big difference. And then Smith being healthy, he's also up there at a solid 65%. His stats are actually almost identical to Kayson Williams so far this season. When you include pass interference penalties, which I do when I chart this, they've been targeted precisely the same number of times, 38 apiece so far, and they both have precisely 404 yards attained, and when you include the receiving yardage in those penalties. So that's pretty impressive to have those two guys basically as mirror images and both very effective. That's 10.6 yards per target, a really solid number.
That's really interesting. I can't believe Jadon Mickens' catch rate is that high.
And his yards per target is actually lower. It's 8.1 because of the fact that it's a lot of the short stuff.
And what are the yards per target for the other receivers?
10.6 apiece.
Oh, wow. And then also kind of the hot button issue on the team has been Austin Seferian-Jenkins and his play this year. And you went through and charted Austin Seferian-Jenkins so far this season.
Yeah, I wanted to look at it because my theory going in is that it's not that Austin Seferian-Jenkins has played poorly necessarily as much as it is the fact that there's just all these other options, and the way that the offense is designed, those are much more quick-hitting options than ASJ up the seam or that sort of thing. And I think Price has just been looking for those guys, and it's not anything that Seferian-Jenkins isn't doing. So, you know, people asking at Coach Sark's weekly radio address on Monday, supposedly someone asked him whether ASJ was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder after his car crash that led to the DUI that had him suspended for the opening game, which it's laughable. That's why we're laughing at it. But anyway, if you look at his stats, you know, he obviously has not been targeted as much this year, but he's catching 70% of the passes thrown his direction. That's a little bit down from his first 2 years. He was at 72% as a freshman. And then last year was also almost at precisely 72%. And then his yards per target is also down. He was 9.6 as a freshman, 8.9 last year when Keith Price was really just forcing it into him and Kayson Williams, and neither of them were quite as effective. And then so far this year, he's at 8.0 yards per target, which is down. I mean, I don't think that he's been great. He certainly hasn't been as good as we expected, but I think a lot of it is he missed time during training camp with the finger injury and then also the suspension. I don't think his rhythm with Keith Price was quite there at the start of the season. The last 2 weeks, he's been throwing 7 balls and he's caught 6 of them. So I think he's fine. I'm not really worried about it.
And going forward, then you would expect that Austin Seferian-Jenkins probably would be a little bit bigger part of the offense for the second half of the season.
I mean, I think at some point, you know, they're probably going to have to look at ways to get him more involved, especially in the red zone. But the way the offense is set up, it's very democratic. You take the option that's best, and oftentimes that hasn't been ASJ this year.
They're going to spread the ball around.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to talk about for the midseason review? Individual defensive players, the defense as a whole?
Well, I think we should talk about the offensive line is probably the most improved part of the team. So, you know, if you look at the advanced numbers, it's interesting because Football Outsiders has two different methods of rating college teams. They have the S&P, which is based on individual plays, and then FEI, which is based on drives. And they actually have slightly different views of the Huskies. FEI says 8th in offense, 33rd in defense, whereas S&P says almost the same, 25th in offense, 17th on defense.
Yeah.
So the strength of the team actually changes depending on which of those views you use. But either way, much improved from last year. They were 60th offensively in FEI, 67th in S&P. So the offense has been a ton better. Keith Price is part of that, having a healthy Keith Price. The offense, the tempo to some extent. But I think it's also the depth and health and experience of the offensive line. You know, when I was doing this charting passes last night, one of the things that really stood out last year was all the sorts of passes that were marked as incomplete by Keith Price that had no particular target, and those are throwaways. He actually completed something like, he actually completed 68% of his passes that were intended to someone. This year it's 74%. Wow. So it's a difference, but it's not as big as the difference in his completion percentage. And that's because of all of those throwaways where he was just constantly under pressure. And that, to me, is a huge difference and probably the single biggest factor, even more than the weapons and the skill positions, why the Husky offense has improved this year.
And then you want to talk about the defense also, which is definitely improved in each of those categories.
It's improved a little bit. Last year it was 37th in FEI. This year up a tiny bit to 33rd. S&P shows more improvement because that considers the Huskies' defense better this year. So there they've gone from 44th to 17th, and believe it or not, fourth against the pass, even after Mariota carved them up last week. And I had to check for sure to make sure that game was included in the stats. But, you know, the defense has been very solid. It's done its job. It's a very difficult job in the Pac-12. They're facing so many good offenses week in and week out. We'll face another really good one on Saturday against Arizona State. But, you know, Justin Wilcox has, you know, other than not being able to find a way to stop Mariota, has done everything possible this season. I don't know if anyone's going to find a way to stop Mariota this year.
And so you mentioned playing a difficult offense in Arizona State. What is the strength of the Arizona State offense kind of looking forward with the Huskies now after 6 weeks?
Well, the intriguing thing is that Arizona State kind of rates similarly to the Huskies overall, at least if you look at S&P, or FEI rather. 10th in offense, 23rd in defense. In S&P, they're 8th offense, 56th defense, so a little bit more of a split. Again, not quite the same thing. But they're a very balanced offense, 6th in running, 7th in passing. You know, have a solid quarterback in Taylor Kelly, although he's been a little bit vulnerable to big interceptions like the pick 6 that cost them against Notre Dame. They have a lot of weapons. You know, Sark was talking on Monday about how he thinks Marion Grice, their running back, is the most underrated guy in the country. They've just got skill position players all over the place. And, you know, very similar stylistically, I think, to the Huskies.
Interesting. Any thoughts on how the Huskies can win this game on Saturday or areas where they might have strength in that game?
Well, one of the interesting things to me is both of these teams, again, mirror image, very poor on special teams. Huh. Arizona State rates 83rd. The Huskies rate 91st, so if one of those teams can come up with a big special teams play, I think that could be a differentiator. But I don't think people realize quite how difficult this game is going to be, because we've gone through the Oregon and Stanford juggernaut and gauntlet, and everyone is focused so much on those games against top 10 opponents. But Arizona State, in terms of the metrics, is not far behind those teams, and especially playing on the road, it doesn't surprise me at all that the Sun Devils are favored by the odds makers.
What is the spread there?
I believe 3.5.
I saw. And that's basically home field advantage.
Yeah, that's saying that those teams are about even on a neutral field.
So that said, chances of winning on Saturday for the Huskies?
I would say somewhere around 40%.
That's what I would say also. Basically, if you're telling me that they're even teams, they're going into Arizona State, you bump them down because of that. Feels like it's about a 40% chance.
It's an important game for both teams, because if you know you're going to lose to Stanford and Oregon, and Arizona State's, obviously UW has already lost to both of those teams, Stanford has already lost to, or Arizona State has already lost to Stanford. I don't know for sure if they have Oregon this season. But it's the games against that second tier in the Pac-12, UCLA, the Arizona States, even Arizona's, those are going to determine what happens with your season. So, you know, I think must win is crazy because, you know, people forget that even if you lost this one, if you won the next 5, you'd still somehow be 9-3. So it's not a must win by any stretch of the imagination. But it is one of those games, along with UCLA, that I think is going to determine just the tone of the Huskies season.
Absolutely. It's going to determine the tone of the Huskies season. Must win is a strange concept. It also is must win for what? It's not necessarily that if you lose this game, your chances of making the playoffs are lower. There's no, basically you can't have a must win in college once you've lost a game, especially if you're not looking at winning your conference.
Well, I think what it is just, it's the way the season will feel. If it's a 9-3 regular season, that feels very different than an 8-4 regular season. And, you know, 8-4 and 7-5, it's a matter of seeing progress. And I think this game and UCLA are what will determine that for the
Huskies. I absolutely agree with you about UCLA, particularly because it's the end of the season. You're probably going to win the two games in between this and UCLA. You would assume that you're going to beat Cal at home and Colorado at home.
Yes.
But that UCLA game and Oregon State are two games that you kind of have to circle on the schedule as games where if you lose one of or both of those games, the tone for the rest of this season, going into the bowl game and going into the next season, is going to be very different.
The other thing that is frustrating about this little stretch for the Huskies is it's the second consecutive week that they've played a team that had played Colorado the week before, which basically is a bye in the Pac-12 schedule this season.
And Arizona State does not play Oregon this season.
Well, that's a very fortunate break for them, fortuitous. But they've played, so the second consecutive week, Arizona State played Colorado last week. The Huskies obviously have been beaten up by the Stanford-Oregon stretch. That's, to me, it seems like a bit of an edge for the Sun Devils going into this one.
But the Huskies have come out of those games relatively healthy.
Yeah, that's the good news.
There's Keith Price's finger injury. Any other injuries?
I don't think anything else of note. Dexter Charles at right guard is questionable, but Eric Kohler stepped up for his first playing time of the season at that position.
Excellent.
Hey, we had one more thing to discuss on the Huskies midseason. Penalties.
Oh, yes.
Huskies third in the nation so far, or second in the nation so far in penalties, and first in penalty yardage. And I took a look at this, did a little quick study, because there's a question of how bad is this? Because to me, I don't really mind penalties that much, because I think that often when you get aggressive penalties, it's because of the fact that you're trying to do good things, and it's actually possible to have too few penalties. So I took a look at that this season and adjusted it for penalties per 140 plays, because part of the reason that the Huskies would still be very high, but part of the reason is because they run so many plays this year with the up-tempo offense. But when I did that research this year, it turns out that there actually is a very slight positive correlation between penalties and success. It's enough that basically there's no relationship whatsoever, but to the extent there is one, it's better to have more penalties than less penalties. The three most penalized teams in the country per play are UW, UCLA is number one in the country, and Florida. And all of those are top 20 teams so far this year.
And that's looking on a per-play basis, assuming, I mean, the Huskies are running a lot of plays also, so looking at total aggregate penalties doesn't necessarily make sense.
It's not enough of a difference to really affect things. But if you were looking at them as opposed to a really slow team, it might be a factor. So, you know, I don't think that those penalties are really something to be particularly worried about. Some of the NFL research has shown that there is a negative effect. Football Outsiders in Football Prospectus 2007 did the research, and they found that offensive penalties hurt your chances of winning, but there's no relationship between defensive penalties and your chances of winning, because again, it's those aggressive plays that you're covering tighter, you're trying to make a play, and that's where you're getting those penalties, as opposed to a mental screw-up or something like that.
Interesting. So we turn our attention to betting. We, last week, discussed the parameters. We're going to Vegas in early December. We're each going to pick one game per week. If I got them all right, I would bet $500 on one game. And we both lost in the first week.
Well, yes. Not a great start.
You picked the Colts -2 at San Diego, and the Colts lost outright.
You did.
I picked the Bears -8, hosting the Giants last Thursday night, and the Bears won the game, but only by 6 points. So this week, figured we'd continue doing it, despite the fact that $500 of my money is no longer on the line. We still want to pick a game and see how we do leading up to that. Boost the confidence a little bit.
Or completely devastated is the case, maybe.
So who are you interested in this week, or should I go first?
I think you should go first, since I'm still looking over these lines.
So I was looking through it last night, and the game that really stood out to me was the Chiefs -7 at home versus the Texans. That game only being a 7-point game, the Chiefs undefeated with the best defense in the NFL, playing against the Texans, who right now are playing like one of the worst teams in the NFL. I think that the Texans are getting a boost in that game because of the previous 3 or 4 years of success. But right now, if we're looking at this season only, you would never assume that the Texans are a good team. They've got the Chiefs, who are great at getting turnovers, especially at turning those turnovers into scoring plays. And then you also have Matt Schaub, who had thrown pick sixes in 4 consecutive games, and TJ Yates, who added a 5th consecutive game to that last week. So I think that the Chiefs at home -7, I would expect the Chiefs to win this game by 14 to 20 points, in that range.
That's a good one. That was one I was definitely looking at. So now that you've taken that off the table, I think I'm going to take San Francisco at Tennessee, despite the fact that they, you know, have played close against Kansas City and Seattle so far in their first two games with Ryan Fitzpatrick starting at quarterback. You know, last week's game could have been a lot more lopsided.
And what is that spread?
That's San Francisco -4 on the road.
That's interesting. I was kind of thinking that that might be a sucker bet. When I was looking at that, I was thinking that
it definitely could be.
Tennessee is a much better team than they're getting credit for right now. And San Francisco is probably a worse team than they're getting credit for right now. I think that both of those teams are being benefited and hurt by their previous seasons.
We'll see if San Francisco can come up with some turnovers from Fitzy. And, you know, I think that their offense will probably be able to do the same kind of things that the Seahawks offense was able to do against Tennessee's.
So we'll check in on that next week, and we'll just lose more money.
Yes, but fortunately it's just imaginary money at this point, so that's the best possible outcome. Well, no, the winning would still be the best possible outcome, but it's not as bad as it could be.
And then tailgating. So last week, again, we predicted that it would be a pretty epic tailgate against Oregon, and it was a pretty epic tailgate against Oregon. I woke up at 5 a.m., we arrived there right around 6:30 a.m. at UW, so it was early.
It was still dark.
It was still dark for another 2 hours, and we had time to go and watch ESPN's College Game Day for a little while, for about an hour or so. And I thought that was really cool. Did you have any thoughts on watching Game Day?
You know, it was a fun experience. I see why people are so excited about having that opportunity and bringing it to their school, and It was always going to be a big game, Washington and Oregon, but that added a little extra juice to it, I think.
It definitely got the energy up, especially having the energy at 6 a.m., having that much energy around campus and people kind of going about. It felt really bustling the whole time.
Absolutely. Signs everywhere.
I learned some things that I learned from that is that people really think that they're clever.
They do.
And that when they do think that they're clever, they like to put their clever thoughts onto signs and try to get those clever thoughts onto TV.
They do. Did you learn whether people actually are clever?
People are not clever.
Oh, that's too bad.
It turns out. I also learned that there are a lot of Washington State Cougar fans, and that Washington State Cougar fans are very excited about the prospects of having a flag with their logo on TV.
Well, I'm glad that that all worked out, because I didn't want it to be like all Cougar fans and them to try to take over UW Game Day, but at the same time, the whole like steal the flag out of their hands thing, that's struck me as just wrong. I mean, they've got a tradition that's gone back many, many years.
It was very mild, I felt. There was not a lot of animosity going on there. Really, I mean, during the game, there was a little bit more animosity with Oregon fans, but especially during game day, there was not a lot of animosity having Oregon and Washington State fans all in that same little area.
Yeah, I mean, I guess people were just so tired that they couldn't be.
It was too early, and that's the thing that you don't note. On the West Coast, it's much earlier going to College Game Day. It's starting at 6 a.m., so you're there when it's dark outside, especially later on in the season.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is at that point, people hadn't really drank as heavily, so that's probably a good thing about starting it that early.
So speaking of starting it that early, we did some heavy drinking very early. Started off the day with a mimosa. I was trying to calculate all the different things that I drank, and I can't remember some of the beers, to be honest. I know that I drank a few beers that I have no idea what they were. But we talk on here often about my advanced palate, and I definitely drank a Bud Light before 7:30 a.m., so that was the earliest I think I've ever drank Bud Light. I was not talking about my advanced palate at that moment.
That's a new record, and, you know, still time to break that.
The drinks that we drank, so there was a mimosa, stirred apple cider on the grill. There was some sort of Northwest Seattle hard cider. Did you have any of that?
I did not.
It was legitimately terrible.
Huh.
I have to say, it was one of the worst things I've ever drank.
Stay away from whatever cider that was.
It kind of tasted like a sour beer with a little bit of a dash of apple thrown into it. And then we drank a few different craft brews. You got the Widmer Oktoberfest.
Yes.
And I definitely drank some of that.
And then Lagunitas IPA.
Oh, the Lagunitas IPA.
My favorite IPA.
I drank four different types of beer, a hard cider, a cider off the grill. Oh, five, if you include Bud Light. Five different types of beer. Cider off the grill, hard cider in the can, and a mimosa. For a total of eight different types of drinks.
What was the number one?
Number one drink was the mimosa, I think. It was the first drink. It was very smooth. It was nice to have at that time. And then I think Rainier was number two. And then Woodmrock, Octo, Lagunitas. I know that hard cider was at the very bottom.
What was the number one food you had is an easier question, I think, to answer.
So we talked about this last week also. I think that there are people who are skeptical about the idea of putting cream cheese on a bratwurst.
We're not just making this up here. We're not just the owners or the presidents. We're the clients here.
It was brilliant. Having the thing that really made it nice, I was thinking the cream cheese out of the little packets that you can squeeze out, but whipped cream cheese, that was especially great. It turned that bratwurst into something magical.
Something magical. What turned my bratwurst into something magical was keeping it in my pocket.
Yeah, you said you had
first quarter of the game.
You had a pocket dog.
I did.
And I had a reindeer in my back pocket for the entire quarter. But the bratwurst, so I said last week that grilled onions, I said caramelized onions, but grilled onions would be a dream condiment.
Your palate recognizes the difference between caramelized onions and grilled onions.
Well, let the palate recognize. So I said that it would be a dream condiment, and we had grilled onions for our barbecue on burgers. But I was so full from eating, because we made breakfast sandwiches, we were there that early. And then I had this bratwurst with the cream cheese on it. Also, Eight different types of drinks that I'd had before this.
It may have factored in.
Complicated that situation. Drinking Lagunitas IPA, even one of those, is like eating a bratwurst.
Is it?
It's the equivalent food-wise in your stomach to eating a full burger or a bratwurst. That's a heavy beer.
Needless to say, it was not a great evening digestive-wise.
But I was unable to eat the burger with the onions on it, despite my dreams literally coming true.
Wow.
I should have shoved it in my pocket like you did, but my pocket was full of beer, so I couldn't.
It doesn't travel. The pocket burger doesn't travel as well as the pocket dog.
Especially if you have the combination of guacamole and ketchup and mayonnaise on your burger. My pockets would have gotten very dirty.
That's a recipe for trouble.
But I have to give a shout out. I had a very, very heavy sausage weekend. And I have to give a shout out to the Munchenhaus in Leavenworth. Went over there for Oktoberfest on Friday during the day before a full weekend of football and more sausages. And the Munchenhaus in Leavenworth, I had the most delicious bratwurst. Their kind of key sausage is the Big Bob sausage. It's big. It's obviously bigger than the Johnsonville brats that we grill. But no cream cheese to be found there because they're doing it German style, not Seattle style.
Yeah.
They had every single kind of mustard that is known to man, though. They had literally 15 different types of mustard. And then I loaded it up with sauerkraut. They have fresh sauerkraut that they grill or that they cook up right there. I loaded it up with sauerkraut. It was a great sausage. But I have to say that the sausage with the whipped cream cheese on it was still better.
Wow, that's how good the cream cheese is.
And that whipped cream cheese was really good. It was great. And so starting at 5 a.m., which we did, and I mentioned the 8 different types of drinks that I had just that day, 2 more the next day. I have to give a shout out to Chris, who was with us for the weekend. I picked him up to go to the Seahawks game on Sunday morning, and he told me that he was 2 hours away from drinking for a full 24 hours. So he drank throughout the game, before the game, starting at about 5 a.m., through the tailgating, the game, went home. He called and left me a message that he found a 40 in his fridge. And then he drank that and then proceeded to continue drinking all the way until 3 a.m. So he made it 22 straight hours of being drinking.
That's pretty impressive stamina, too, especially then go to attend a second football game the next day.
No effect whatsoever on him the next day. We sat down and started tailgating for the Seahawks game, and he was equally as eager to drink beer as he was the day before. He told me that throughout the weekend he drank out of the 48 total hours. 40 hours of drinking.
I don't think I was awake for 40 hours of the weekend.
That's really what going to a Husky game and a Seahawks game back to back and starting your tailgating at 5 a.m. can do to a person's liver. Is make you drink for 48 straight hours. So it was an impressive streak, and I felt like it needed to be mentioned here. I told him when he picked me up and said that he had almost drank for 24 hours. I was like, I'm going to remember those times to mention this later because you need credit for this.
Yeah.
And he's still walking to this day. And then fantasy football. So we play each other this week. It's a heated rivalry. We're both tied for first place. I'm in first place because I have way more points than you have. But we have the same record at 4-2. And it gets a bit heated between us when we play fantasy football.
Actually, really, it does. It just becomes both of us thinking we're going to lose throughout the game. That's usually how most of our fantasy football matchups work.
I don't know if I think I'm going to lose throughout the game.
All right. I guess that's just me.
That's when you and Nick play each other.
Yeah.
You both think it's a lose fest. Somehow you both lose. But do you care? So you lost $5 to me last week.
I did.
On a bet about Jay Cutler scoring 20 or more fantasy points, which he did.
Barely. By one rushing yard. If he had been one rushing yard fewer.
Would you like to make a friendly wager, a bit of a side bet?
Well, I think we should do something on the podcast besides a monetary wager. I don't know what that would be, but...
I had some sort of embarrassment. Humiliation to happen is what
you're looking... Maybe you should have to drink a Coors Light.
That's not that bad. I could drink a Coors Light. I should have to drink a Coors Light.
Yeah, from what I've heard, that's the most horrible thing someone could do to you.
You have to shotgun a beer then. Because you have vehemently... Okay. If I win... At the next home Husky game, which is California, correct? Which is Cal on October 26th. At the next home Husky game, you have to shotgun two beers.
Two?
Two beers. And if I win, we drink... Wait. If you win, we drink Coors Light instead of Rainier that day. Really, that's just a punishment for everybody.
Yeah, it kind of is.
Okay. Here we go. Here's the idea.
Hey, we never talked about the fact that we have a logo.
Oh, yeah. We have a logo. If you win, wait, I want to flesh this idea out. If you win, I will drink Coors Light and everybody else will drink Rainier. Does that sound like appropriate enough punishment?
Yeah.
You had to give some thought to that.
Well, I want to remember the Cal game.
Oh, you're scared of the shotgunning. Okay, one beer.
All right.
You have to successfully shotgun one beer, though.
That's fair.
You have to get 90% of the liquid down. You have to get 10 ounces down.
Okay.
Is that a deal? That's a deal? And I will have to get my own personal Coors Light to drink.
Yes.
All right, I'm happy that we've got ourselves. That's much better than a monetary bet.
Way better.
I like this idea. But so as looking forward, I was breaking down the stats, and I noticed that the Chiefs defense is the top non-quarterback scorer in fantasy right now.
You notice this because you're on your team.
Oh, I've been noticing it throughout the year. But this week I've been especially monitoring it. And the Chiefs have been so insanely good. I mean, they're really propelling my team from being a good team to being easily the best team in our league, outscoring the second place team by almost 100 points. And so I was thinking, how good is this Chiefs defense? Right now, they're averaging 19.2 fantasy points per game. Wow. Obviously, they're better than the star running backs who are out there, star wide receivers. I mean, if you were to redraft right now, I could see the Chiefs defense going in the top three rounds.
If you were to know with exact certainty that they would continue doing this all season, yes.
So I figured we would compare them to the most notable defense of all time, which is the 1985 Bears, correct?
Yes.
It's a common phrase, they're not the 85 Bears, they are the 85 Bears, etc. And so I broke down, I went back in time, and I looked at the fantasy football scores for the 1985 Chicago Bears, and I learned that the Kansas City Chiefs from this year so far are significantly better than the Chicago Bears are. So right now they're at 19.2 fantasy points per game, the Chiefs. The Chicago Bears, through 6 weeks in 1985, were averaging 13.3 fantasy points per game. Now, they finished the season strong, and their 15-1 season there with an amazing defense.
And Hurricane Ditka.
And Hurricane Ditka. They finished the season with 16.93 fantasy points per game. They picked it up in the second half of the year, but that's still 2.5 fantasy points less per game than the Chiefs have.
Now, ordinarily, I would say that the Chiefs are likely to regress to the mean and that they can't keep up scoring this many defensive touchdowns. But then you look at their schedule, and other than the two games against Denver, man, there are some really favorable matchups for them starting this week against Houston and their five-week run of pick sixes.
The Chiefs have a very easy schedule going forward. Those two Broncos matchups scare you a little bit. I'm going to throw them out there personally on the first Broncos game and see what happens. And if they get destroyed by the Broncos, obviously I'll reconsider it for the second game. So we determined, let's see here. Do they play the Broncos? They go at Denver for the first one, so that's a little bit scary.
Yeah.
I would prefer them to be hosting Denver for that first one. But going forward, they have Houston at home, Cleveland at home with Brandon Whedon, at Buffalo and potentially Thad Lewis.
Then, or Matt Flynn.
Then Denver, then they host San Diego, at Washington, at Oakland, hosting Indianapolis, and at San Diego. There is not a scary game aside from Denver in that entire bunch.
I mean, I guess Indianapolis.
Hosting Indianapolis in week 16 doesn't feel that scary to me. The The chances of them, I don't think that they're going to continue at 19.2 points per game.
No, probably not.
But the chances of them beating the 85 Bears fantasy points-wise, seems like there's a very good chance of that for the full season.
I mean, you'd need an average of about 15 a game the rest of the way, I think, doing some quick math in my head.
In the second half of the season, the Bears, the 85 Bears, had a zero in the game that they lost at the Dolphins. And that was in the second half when they really picked it up. They also had a 38 fantasy-wise in there.
Wow.
And a 33. So they were a pretty good defense.
Yeah, I've heard some good things about them.
And then waivers-wise...
We're not going to talk about it this week.
We have agreed that we cannot talk about it this week.
It's too heated.
We can name... you can see right there on my screen your pending moves. There are four of them. I've got four waiver claims in, and you also have four waiver claims in?
I do, at three different positions.
So mine are not at three different positions, but we cannot discuss waiver claims. There are too many feelings that are happening here. So we pretty much have to wrap up fantasy there. And then, like always... We wrap up the podcast by comparing Vic Ballard and Jermaine Kearse.
Well, I didn't even do the update this week. Jermaine Kearse had what, 1 point last week? This is great audio. We look this up on our computers. Who's going to get there first?
Jermaine Kearse has 20 points overall, and he put up a one last week.
Yeah, but two catches. Three for first downs.
Three catches for 17 yards. Put up a one. He was a bigger part.
That's right. He had the third catch where he actually lost yardage.
He was a bigger part of the offense, and he got more snaps than he has in the past. But
apparently, that doesn't blocking really well in the end does not really translate very well in fantasy terms. But still, dominating Vic Ballard.
He is really crushing Vic Ballard. All right. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.